what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. You are listening to All Ball. This is All Hoop All the Time, although I will point out that once we get past the NBA Finals, and sometimes here during the NBA playoffs, we are going to bring you either fans of basketball, basketball players, basketball coaches, basketball guys, ball guys, and sometimes talk about stuff outside of ball, you know, people's life stories and things that are interesting to you. So I appreciate you listening to this episode. Please subscribe, download, and by the way, don't be afraid to rate our podcast. Let's dig in with a couple of things going on in the world, first of college basketball. I guess I'm supposed to sit here and tell you all these things about the latest with the FBI investigation and how somehow a couple of schools have been deemed to be victims of what's taken place with the folks at Adidas. I don't honestly know the outcome. I do know that the timing of it, it's like the FBI, they had, you know, the arrests were made before the season began. Then we had some drip of information right before the NCAA tournament. Then it was like, we're not going to do anything during the NCAA tournament. And now they do it in the spring. And the issue with that is this. Spring recruiting has become everything in college basketball. Sure, you can sign some guys in the fall, but so many players are waiting to see where their coaches go, assistant coaches go, who goes to the draft, doesn't go to the draft. It's just fascinating to watch. Fascinating to watch because now all of a sudden Kansas is somehow ensnarled in it, and there's the thought that their kind of dream class that's coming there, I mean, looks to be good, looks to be an elite type of team with the Lawson brothers sitting out, even though they've lost, you know, Malik Newman early to the NBA draft. But, you know, what happens with their current roster, especially when you have a freshman who isn't named but is essentially named as his mom taking money, and then you got incoming players, and do they arrive? The thing is kind of craziness. We'll get back to college basketball, but the FBI thing is interesting only in that, just tell me where the dust settles. It's a lot like all these players declaring for the NBA draft. Many of them not signing with an agent. A lot of this becomes nonsensical. You know where you're going. You know you're not going to get drafted or be a second-round draft pick at best. You should go back to school, and yet they're still keeping their name in the draft. But there have been some Trayvon Duval, for example, leaving Duke, signing with an agent, which I don't know if he would have started with Trey Jones. I probably would have liked to see them in the backcourt together. You look at Quinn Cook's evolution to now becoming an NBA player with the Golden State Warriors, and you wonder, Trayvon Duval, granted, completely different player, but more time at Duke, would he have been more likely to be an NBA draft pick? Instead, now he's going to have to fight his way to the league. If he gets drafted, it'll be second round. So there's some interesting stuff there with the NBA draft. I give you my top five for the draft upcoming, and we'll talk about when the dust settles what the college basketball landscape's going to look like. But the main focus of All Ball this week is the NBA playoffs. And I would love to say you can draw on all this information from the NBA's regular season, and that's what the playoffs are going to look like. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you just love to say, like, all right, exactly how you – that's what they do in Major League Baseball. Granted, the pressure is ramped up and the importance of every pitch is ramped up, but because baseball, the stats are so in-depth, so insightful, and so broken down by not just versus lefty versus righty, versus each different count. And I'll grant you that you put the pressure of postseason baseball on players and you're not going to get the same result. You're not going to get Derek Jeter, same average in regular season, same average in postseason. But that's generally how we evaluate what a player is going to do. Here's what they did in this situation against this hitter. And baseball players kind of program themselves to that. So in many ways, once you get a big enough sample size in baseball, there are some outliers, but the regular season guy becomes the postseason guy. The NBA is not that way because you have almost half the teams were tanking this year. Even teams that were playoff teams had players take substantial time off. You know, James Harden, who's likely to be the NBA's MVP, he didn't play 10 of the games. So how do you quantify his stats? Like, let's just say James Harden. How do you quantify his stats versus, like, LeBron's stats? LeBron didn't practice because they don't practice, but he did play every game. So James Harden's stats look better per game, but would they have been as good if he played all 82? And look, I'm not criticizing James Harden for sitting out, because the truth is that everything James Harden has accomplished to date goes out the window if they lose early in the playoffs. It just does. We just say, all right, he's a regular season guy. That's what we do. Your legacy is not built upon MVPs. Your legacy is built upon what you do in the playoffs, especially in the NBA. So I'm not criticizing him for sitting out 10 games. What I am pointing out, though, is this is the old prorated stuff. This is the old, yeah, coach, you know, if I played 35 minutes, if I played 38 minutes, I would be. Bench guys say this all the time. Hey, if I was, I'm playing 20 minutes a game, I'm averaging 8 a game. If you played me 30 minutes, I'd be averaging 12 a game, right? And I would be, instead of averaging 5 assists, I'd be averaging almost 8 assists. Just prorate my numbers. The difference is, when you're starting, you're playing against better players. You're also playing more minutes, so maybe you don't have as much juice in the tank on a nightly basis to go out and play at the same level of efficiency. Playing even longer minutes, but against better players, and more games and more minutes can, in fact, wear you down. So I use the James Harden, LeBron James as the jumping-off point for it's really hard for the entire league to evaluate who is what. And look at the Cavaliers. As good a shooting team as they can be, they shot the ball terribly in game one of the NBA playoffs. LeBron James having, as a jump shooter, his best jump shooting season as a pro, he's 0 of 10 outside the paint in game one. So it's really hard to correlate regular season stats to postseason stats. The game is, though not as physical as it used to be, is far more physical than it is regular season. The rotations are generally tighter, and the importance of each possession is ramped up. Case in point, the Philadelphia 76ers. I'm recording this podcast on, was this Tuesday afternoon? On Monday evening, the 76ers were down 20, got it to within 4, and took bad shot after bad shot, turned the ball over, don't box out, and the attention to detail is lacking. Brett Brown, head coach of the 76ers, is going to join us. We'll share that with you here on All Ball later on the podcast. So it's really hard to correlate regular season to postseason. And the San Antonio Spurs are probably the best example of that. You watch them, and granted, playing without Kawhi Leonard, but here's a team won 47 games. You're like, man, that is, there's not a lot of talent out there. Like, Tony Parker had his worst season in the last, since his rookie year. Manu's 40 years old, and though spriteful for 40 years old, he's still 40 years old. LaMarcus Aldridge has been reinvigorated this year, but he's still kind of a mid-range to low-post sort of player. He's almost a dinosaur, considering how most teams play. DeJounte Murray doesn't shoot it well enough, isn't there yet. I think eventually he'll be there. And this is the Spurs team playing without Kawhi Leonard, their best player. So how did they win 47 in the regular season? And right now they're 0-2 in the postseason. One, they're playing against a higher level of team. And postseason is just different. Just different. We saw Klay Thompson, and he's been hot from three, going up against the Spurs, and they just have too many weapons. And yet, this is not a super talented Golden State team. It's not a team that stretches the floor nearly as well as you think they do. They don't throw weapon after weapon after weapon. If you don't have Steph Curry, now you have Quinn Cook or Andre Iguodala, or Sean Livingston. That shrinks the court a great deal. That puts another guy in the lap. You're playing JaVale McGee. That's another guy in the lane that you don't have to guard outside the perimeter. Even Draymond Green, who will occasionally knock in some threes, he only made 30% of the year. You can shrink the court. So the court is much more condensed than it usually is with Golden State, not just because Steph is awesome, but also Steph just demands so much attention. He spaces the floor for others. It's part of the makeup of this team and how it's perfectly constructed when it's all together, but it's so imperfectly constructed when it's not. It makes his return even more interesting. I'm convinced that Brad Stevens is a witch. There's no other reason for him to be able to win games, you know, when they don't have, you don't have Kyrie, you don't have Gordon Hayward, you don't have Marcus Smart, and you beat the Milwaukee Bucks. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But they play really hard, they space you out, and, you know, I mean, the ending sequence of regulation was remarkable. Do I think that dog will hunt long term? No, I really don't. That series feels like Giannis, although Giannis at some point is going to have to be able to make a jump shot, although he keeps getting to the rim. And there's some weird stuff going on with Prunty's rotations, which are kind of hard to figure out. But it feels like this is one of those series to which Boston has no right to win, and yet they might win it anyway. Regardless of which, if I'm the 76ers and I can figure out how to take down Dwayne Wade and the Miami Heat, I feel really good about matching up with either of those teams heading forward, especially considering to this point I've done it without Joel Embiid. As for the 76ers, yes, they need Embiid, but also they need to grow up a little bit. Between taking bad shots, between turning the basketball over, Ben Simmons has shown no desire to take jump shots, which is smart because he's not a good jump shooter. But, like, look, they are giving you 10-footers. They are giving you 15-footers. He can make those. It's a weird thing that he does to which he just won't even look at it. I mean, look at it all. Giannis takes some that he can't make, but at least he steps into it to try and, if he makes one, you feel like you got to play him a little bit more honestly. If I'm the 76ers, do I relent and put Embiid in? Look, it's his eye. If he's wearing a mask and the doctors tell you he's going to be fine, the eye issue with Embiid reminds me a lot of how we handle concussions in the NBA, concussions in soccer. I understand that we don't want our athletes to be living with concussions and be dealing with continuous concussions. But this is kind of our knee-jerk, crazy reaction to the NFL world. Look, the NFL has guys who are suffering from CTE, memory loss, brain damage, from tens to hundreds to maybe even more concussions during their lifetime in playing football. They're killing themselves or feel like they're dying from within, or they suffer things like ALS that many people thought are triggered by CTE, by continuous blows to the head. There aren't basketball players walking the earth that have memory loss problems because they suffered a concussion while playing in college or the pros. It doesn't exist. And so though we want to be extra vigilant and not let players come back early from concussions, sometimes doctors are overdoing it, right? It's like if you sprain your ankle, your doctors will be like, hey, don't do anything for a month. If a basketball player sprains their ankle, they'll be like, look, I'll take a couple of days off. I'll ice it. I'll stim it. I'll be back. I'll start rehabbing in a couple of days, depending on, obviously, the severity of the sprain. We're holding that kind of same knee-jerk extra sensitivity of average guy or almost football guy to basketball players with concussions or basketball players with injury. I don't think Joel Embiid should have spoken out, should have Instagrammed out that he's being babied, but I do understand that, look, if he's fine to play, he's fine to play. The likelihood he gets hit in the eye and re-breaks his face is very, very slight. Russell Westbrook did play with a broken face and did play with that mask and seemed to be fine. So, you know, and there's a guy that plays harder, jumps into contact more than anybody I've seen. The East, I look at it as this. I think Toronto wins. I don't know what happens with Cleveland. We'll break it down for you upcoming. I'm kind of neutral as to what happens with Boston. I think Boston is the inferior talented team, but they do feel like a team that will find a way to win, whereas Milwaukee will find a way to lose it. And I do think ultimately the Sixers win. My issue is that what I thought about the Cavs, maybe this is some confirmation bias, I thought eventually they'll probably find their way through the East, but there's a good chance they'll be just broken down by and battered by an elongated series with the Pacers, an elongated series with the Raptors, an elongated series with maybe the 76ers or maybe the Heat or whomever they play. And one, there's a likelihood for an upset. There's a likelihood for an injury with some of their older parts. But more than anything, it beats them up to when they play the Warriors or play the Rockets in the finals. They won't have the best version of themselves. Whereas last year they had a great opportunity. Last year they only played 13 games. So they're fresh as a daisy, rested. They just weren't good enough. They just didn't match up well. So in addition to the fact that there's no perfect lineup for the Cavs. Their best offensive lineup is a terrible defensive lineup. Their best defensive lineup is a bad offensive lineup. In addition to that, they're very likely to play three long series before they even get to the Rockets or get to the Warriors, which greatly decreases their ability to win in the playoffs to begin with. Then you go to the West, and this is what I said about the Thunder to start the year. They remind me of Kevin Durant's last Thunder team, where there's kind of a mismatch piece of parts, but they do have some very, very talented scorers. 2.5, in fact. I mean, I mentioned Melo. He used to be the best scorer in the league, but he's a shell of himself. Now he's just a catch-and-shoot jump shooter. But remember, that was the team that was up 3-1 the Warriors. And that's what this team feels like. That, look, you get to the playoffs, and you got to have some vets that can make shots. They have two. I know that Paul George didn't make big shots last year with the Pacers. So far, he's made them with the Thunder. But you got Paul George. You got Russell Westbrook. You got Carmelo Anthony. You know, you got a bunch of time off in between games. You got Steven Adams. Like, I think they're going to be a bitch for the Rockets to beat. And I think that the Jazz are much like the San Antonio Spurs. Ridiculously well-coached and surprising how good they are. But what you do in the regular season, and once you get to the postseason, you need vets, you need better players. And they just don't have the Jimmys and the Joes to match up with the Thunder. So I think you got Thunder and Rockets. And one of the issues with the Rockets is that Karl Towns either doesn't want the ball enough or they don't want him to get him the ball enough. But I do think that the Timberwolves can stretch out the Rockets, can force it to a fifth game, to a sixth game, can wear them down, to which it wouldn't stun me at all if the Thunder were able to beat the Rockets. I know that sounds crazy, but look, you have Russell Westbrook who can guard James Harden. You know, you have to have somebody who commands the respect of the league in order to guard whether it's James Harden or Chris Paul, right? Especially James Harden. Now, look, the Thunder are not as good defensively without Andre Robertson, and he would do a great job on James Harden. But he doesn't have the respect of a Russell. He doesn't have the respect of a Paul George, so that James Harden, when he drives, he won't get the calls that he gets in the regular season. But again, my fear for the Rockets is much like my fear for the Cavs. I think right now, if you just played rested 7-game series against the Warriors, Steph not fully back from injury, there's no reason to believe that they couldn't win 4 out of 7. I believe it could happen. But I think that the road that they're on, the Warriors getting the Spurs without Kawhi, that feels like a sweep. That feels like it'll give them a chance to get fresh, rested, get Steph back. You look at who they'll match up with in the second round, as opposed to the Rockets matching up with the Thunder. I think this thing opens wide open for the Warriors to get back, to be fully healthy, whomever they play in that second series, feel really, really good about slowly integrating Steph Curry from an injury that he suffered 2 years ago, and he knows how to kind of measure how many minutes he plays. And you still have Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson, and though the pieces aren't great, they're a lot better when they're only playing 4-game series as opposed to 6- or 7-game series. All right, let's check in with a guy. If you don't follow him on Twitter, then I feel like you don't watch the NBA. He's Coach Nick, and he's got a super popular site and Twitter handle, at B-Ball Breakdown. Of course, does NBA analysis. You can see the videos. It's almost live. It's almost like play happens. Go to his Twitter feed, and you can see kind of his breakdown of how he sees what happened and why it happened. Coach in his own right, and of course, provides live in-game video analysis. Again, at B-Ball Breakdown, has his own podcast that I've been on. You should download it as well. He joins us here on the All Ball Podcast. So, Nick, we're a couple games into the playoffs. Let's start with, again, this is being recorded as of Tuesday, midday LA time, afternoon East Coast time. And you're going to get a chance to hear Brett Brown, 76ers head coach, a little bit later on in the pod. Let me ask you about Dwayne Wade. I said this on TV about Dwayne Wade. He's like Derek Jeter, where, like, I don't think Derek Jeter is one of the top 10, top 15 baseball players of all time. But Derek Jeter hit, what, he had 5 hits? He had 5 hits in his last game as a Yankee. He had a home run for his 3,000th hit. He has the ability to dial it up in big instances. Dwayne Wade statistically is not a very good shooter. But you know what? I ain't giving Dwayne Wade an open shot in a big game. What do you account for Dwayne Wade's resurgence, especially in Game 2 last night against the Sixers?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think this is the nature of the age that he's at, is that, you know, he has the ability from time to time to call up this, you know, this ability that he used to have when he was Flash. I don't expect it to happen that often or that consistently, but, yeah, it's hard to know exactly. I'm not even sure he knew. They asked at the end of the game, it's kind of like, what was that all about? Like, what did you eat for breakfast or something? And I think that, you know, there was a moment where he knows they go down 2-0 on the road. That's it. The series is over. And there's probably some sort of romantic notion of this could be it for him completely. He wasn't, you know, there was how it is. We're of an age where every once in a while when you need to call upon it, you know, if you're trying to save your kid and you have that superhuman strength, as a parent, that's sort of what Dwayne Wade seemed to have done. They're playing him well in a way that they're giving him extra rest. He's coming off the bench, so he's not going to be completely exhausted. But I'll be frank, I'm doing a video on it right now for my YouTube channel, and there's plenty of close-ups of him huffing and puffing, you know, and looking a bit tired and winded early in the game.
Yeah, no, there's no question he can dig deep, but the ability to it's – I don't know if you remember when Dwayne Wade won an NBA championship with Shaq. Shaq only played well one of those games, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's just one game which he could – and that's what older players can do. It's the – I liken it to – there's a Toby Keith song. I ain't as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was, right? One time it's vintage Wade. I learned more about the Sixers there, and I know that they don't have Embiid, and that changes things dramatically. But it does feel like – the continuing daring Simmons to shoot and the fact that, you know, in order for them to come back, they had to put their shooters out on the floor, but they don't value possessions well enough. They don't necessarily take – unless Ben Simmons creates a great shot for him, a lot of times they're taking contested chuck-up threes, if you will. And they have a little bit of the Cavs problem, which is their best defensive lineup isn't their best offensive lineup. They can't play their best players. There's a bit of a mismatch with it. What do you think of the Sixers now that we've seen them in two playoff games?
Well, what you said was perfect, and I think when I was watching the game live, I was sort of tweeting out saying, this is the future of basketball. This is what modern NBA will look like in 5 or 6 years, where for the first, like, 6, 7 minutes of the game, you didn't see one triple threat. There was not one time, I don't think either team caught the ball, like, ripped through, held it for a second. Everything was attack off the catch. It was dizzying how fast it was going. The shots were, you know, crazy, some of them. And, you know, I had tweeted by the end of the game that Bellinelli must have been drunk because of the things he was throwing up. So this is the problem where we're seeing, you know, the fits and starts of what the game is moving towards, especially without Embiid. And they haven't quite learned how to sort of handle that speed because down the stretch when they needed really good shots, their offense is predicated on read and react and ball movement and, you know, looking for that first quick shot, open shot. And so you can see that the final, I don't know, I have to look at the footage one more time, but I bet you the last, like, 10 shots in the game were just terrible shots, horrible threes, just flying up Bellinelli, the whole thing. And that's the problem with a young team. They haven't learned. I don't know if Brett Brown has the experience either to handle that, where they need to be calling sets down the stretch, right? He needs to be saying, we're going to run this set. We're going to get a shot for him here and then let Simmons get attacking in the right positions. Otherwise, if it's going to be free-form, read and react, then they're going to struggle, probably not necessarily as much in this series. I think they're still going to be able to win this series. But, you know, once they get out of the first round, then they're going to need to figure out how to, you know, generate better shots. And, of course, Mr. Embiid comes back, and that does change a lot of the dynamic.
Yeah, although I will point out that Embiid, with his lack of postseason experience, college or pro, he's the type of guy who, you know, it could be a two-point game, and he can hunt a three just like anybody else. Like, no, dude, like, look, when we get to the last couple minutes of a fourth quarter playoff game, we want you down at the block making plays. So, you know, his understanding of time, score, possession, I think, will mirror what we've seen from the 76ers, which is that's just they're playing the same way they play in the regular season, same way they played first three quarters. That's not how it works in the postseason. Speaking of young big guys, Karl Towns didn't get a lot of touches in game one for the Minnesota Timberwolves. And I think there's two sides to it. One, he's got to demand the ball. Maybe three sides to it. One, he's got to demand the ball. Two, Tibbs has got to run stuff for him, although Tibbs' offensive acumen, his defense cannot be questioned. Their intensity cannot be questioned in terms of play. I felt like they did a really good job in trying to execute some of their game plan defensively. But offensively, God, there's some ugly possessions. But then there's also this, hey, is Jimmy Butler going to throw it to Karl Towns? Like, is Andrew Wiggins going to throw it to Karl Towns? Even Gorgie Deng, is he going to throw it to Karl Towns? What do you think of, how do you get Karl Anthony Towns the ball against the Rockets?
Right. It's a conundrum because he's not the guy who's going to bring the ball up, and he's not, like, the perimeter guy who they're going to kind of throw it to either. So he needs to have those guys feed him the ball. I don't know if offensively, like you said, just how fluid that what Tibbs is doing is really, you know, how that really works. Because, yes, but there were were times, by the way, where we did see with Karl-Anthony Towns, like they were being ultra physical whenever they could with him, any chance they could get their hands on him. And he's just not a physical player, and he would shy away from it. And I saw a couple of possessions where he was sort of in the way, and then you have sort of like Ariza sort of manhandling him, and then he kind of just floats to the corner and just sort of stands there. He had a chance to get offensive rebound or a tip, but he just didn't go. So he, you know, is clearly reeling from the effects of, like, what the postseason is, having not experienced it before, and just how intense and how physical it is. You know, you got guys like P.J. Tucker out there who, you know, have this is their chance to really, you know, maybe win a title, right? This guy is going to be relentless and anywhere he can to get it. So I think Towns is going to have to learn how to handle that better. He's already got footwork issues, and that in terms of mechanically, I feel like his knees and his ankles and the way they move together, it's so, you know, he needs to fix that if he wants to become take the next step. And so as a result, like, yeah, he'll be off balance, and he's going to be pushed around. And, you know, I'm sure kids can say in the huddles and in the practice today before they're preparing, hey, we got to find him. And they were trying to find him a little bit. They were setting screen and rolls, and he was getting a switch. But then you have to rely on Wiggins or Butler to, like, recognize it quickly and get it to him before he is either pushed out or fades away. Look, I might want to make one more point about the whole thing, though, is I'm a little bit concerned that I think Jeff Teague is the thing that ultimately holds them back. I think he had a decent box score game, but there's so many little things he does wrong that are so average or below average that I think he's going to be the guy, and he's sort of he's done that wherever he's been, that kind of just keeps the team at a very meh level, and you're not going to rise above with him. He's going to be okay, but I think that's the real key.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the other part to Jeff Teague is, you know, you struggle small guards, you struggle with switches and not switching, and boy, you really got to make up for your lack of size. Not that they're going to post you, but in terms of on the offensive boards, how you play, they kind of switched and they're giving up that mid-range pull up to James Harden, who really manipulates the ball screen well and then just kind of, all right, you're going to switch and wait for me in the paint, and I'm going to step back and shoot that half-travel, half-step-back jump shot.
right.
I guess here's my question. I feel like, look, I think the Rockets are going to beat the Timberwolves, but I do think the Timberwolves can push him, maybe win a game or two. I think the Thunder can win a couple of games. They might even be able to beat the Rockets, and I look at the Warriors, and we all thought, end of the season, that's not a great team. They're not sharp. I even watched some of their lineups last night. It's not nearly as good as the Warriors of old. But I like how few of games they'll have to play before they get to the Rockets as opposed to what the Rockets will have to go through. The same for the Cavs. Like, even if the Cavs do get to an NBA Finals, I feel like they're going to have to go through 5, 6, 7-game series to get there.
Oh, well, without question. I mean, this Pacers series, in theory, is going to go 7, you know, if they're going to win it. They're already down 1-0, and the road team, you know, when they take the first game, becomes a favorite in the series. So, you know, and a lot of their issues, and I got back and forth on Twitter with my buddy Mike Zavano about this, but, you know, the game was over in the first quarter. Once they went down by 20, you know, all the energy they expended to make it closer later just was too little too late. And it was their defense with Kevin Love, which is kind of mirroring what's going on with Karl-Anthony Towns, because a team like the Rockets, they're relentless in kicking out the one person they're going to want to attack. And they were bringing Karl-Anthony Towns up in the pick and roll. And, you know, he had a couple possessions where he's able to kind of pressure and maybe make Harden miss a shot or two. But Harden was getting layups. They were getting open shots from that. So that's the other issue that Towns is going to have to figure out, independent of the offense, is that he's going to have to get better defensively, and it's just not going to happen now. I don't know if Tibbs is ever going to get him motivated because of his style just might not ever really work with a guy like Karl-Anthony Towns. And then, you know, with Cleveland, we can't talk about Cleveland. We can't talk about OKC getting to the next round. I still think that the Jazz have a really good shot at beating them there too. So, you know, it's going to be a fascinating playoff series as we get closer to the end of the first round.
It is. Let's get to Cleveland. Here's always been my thing. You have Kevin Love. You need Kevin Love for offense, but it's really hard to hide Kevin Love for defense. And it's hard to hide him for two different factors. If you play him at center, well, now LeBron becomes your rim protector. You don't really want that. If you play him at power forward, well, now LeBron has to cover a 3. And then whoever you play at 5, whether it's Larry Nance and going small, or Tristan Thompson, who I know is not bigger than Larry Nance, but he is more of a true rim protecting big, even though he's only about 6'8". But you know, neither of those guys stretch the floor, so they shrink the floor with LeBron trying to play in and out of that post. Like, I think they got a bunch of mismatched pieces. Ty Lue said, we didn't get the chance to play our five best players. What is the best lineup for them to win this series?
Oh, geez. Well, I rip Kevin Love to no end on a defensive end. And so what I've said is, if he's not scoring 25 points in the game, then he's a liability. You have to cut his minutes. But, again, you look down that roster, you know, Rodney Hood is not doing what I've been hoping he's been doing since, you know, for the last couple of years. It's just not going to happen, I don't think, in Cleveland. And so now you got to figure out, yeah, what is that lineup? I don't think I know. I sort of imagine that Tristan Thompson playing and playing more would probably have to be part of their solution. I feel like at some point earlier this year when, like, he had been playing a lot and it kind of stuck him in there and they started doing better again, it was like, yeah, you remember when he was active on defense and he was getting tip-ins, like that's what they need. They don't get as much. But LeBron is never going to be a rim protector. As far as I could tell, he's just, that switch is off. He doesn't seem to want to rotate, doesn't want to move. And I got to tell you, in the first quarter, he was so unaggressive. He didn't take a shot until like a minute left in the first quarter. They played him the entire first and then a couple minutes into the second. He was exhausted by that point because they were down so much. So LeBron's got to figure out how to be, you know, aggressive and still facilitate, because it's either for him, it's like, I'm going home, I'm going to get mine, or I'm just going to sit in the corner. Like, I have a shot in the breakdown on my video on YouTube where, like, literally, it looked like 4-on-5. He was so deep into the corner standing there for 10 seconds, I couldn't even see him. He blended in with the bench. So he's got to stop doing that and figure out where he can move and get more movement. Otherwise, the Pacers were pushing up on them. Tremendous pressure. The stagnant offense that's already stagnant anyway let them wall up on LeBron, and that's why they were really struggling to get good shots.
And then the Pacers, you mentioned their aggressiveness defensively. It points out that the need for a Kyrie Irving, right? The need for somebody who can break down the defense, which I guess becomes Jordan Clarkson, but he's not a good defender. He's an up and down shooter, and he's not somebody who creates shots for others, right? Like, he's a come off the bench scorer. And anytime he's had to play starters minutes against starting caliber players, he's gotten exposed as being much better off the bench. Is that the tweak that Tyronn Lue makes, playing Jordan Clarkson more?
I mean, yeah, I suppose. I mean, in my mind, at least with the starters, the solution to combating their aggressiveness is you got to move the ball, right? You got to get some side-to-side action. That's just not what they do. And especially if you don't have a Kyrie Irving in the starting lineup like that. You can't conjure him out of thin air. It's definitely not Clarkson. Clarkson's a guy, you know, he's good off the bench. Give him the 18, 20 minutes, he'll get you your 12 points and whatever. But, they don't have that. And LeBron seems to be unwilling, or Lue, whoever is in, you know, is controlling that team. They're like, I'm going to back down. We're going to slow this down. We're going to try and precision, you know, attack the mismatches we want. But man, it wasn't pretty offensively at all for them. And unless they get more ball movement, more player movement, more off ball screens, those kind of things that will combat a pressure defense. These young Indiana, they're not intimidated. That's the other thing. They are not intimidated. They are getting up in their grill. They are attacking. Oladipo looks like, you know, an all star. I mean, was he an all star this year? He was an all star, wasn't he?
He had to be an all star, wasn't he?
I think so, but either way, he looks like, you know, the premier guard in the Eastern Conference, and just isolating back. He backed up on LeBron and just took a running start and pulled up and hit a three in his face. It's like, that doesn't happen.
I'm not sure we care about the outcome, but what the Celtics simply even being competitive with the Bucks, considering their roster right now. Like, do we build the statue? Brad Stevens hadn't really won anything yet in the NBA, and yet I think he's won all of our hearts and minds. Fair?
Fair. I mean, he's had my mind in my heart for a long time. And I think it's mostly because of, you know, by the way, if you want to compare like him versus like Tibbs, right? Tibbs is a yeller. You know, I'm sure you've had coaches like that at different levels that are just got in your face and forcing you to be intense. You know, Brad Stevens doesn't have to do that. And you can't say that those teams don't play hard. His Celtic teams are all over the place. And I think it's that positive frame of mind that they play in, that confidence they have knowing that they're prepared, it really goes a long, long way against even a team like Milwaukee that has tumultuous The dad left them in the middle of the year, and now they have the stepdad, and it's clear that they're not quite all on the same page.
No question. So do you think the Cavs get beat in this series against the Pacers?
You know, I love the underdog. I got to admit it. That's why people think I'm a hater on LeBron on Twitter, just because, I don't know, I actually enjoy watching, like, Oladipo go at him and score and have success, because he's been the best for so long. So, you know, I kind of been leaning toward that. I felt like all year long they were in danger of certainly not making a very deep playoff run. So that's the question here is, when does that playoff run end? You know, the Pacers now have home court advantage. They did play over their head, and they hit shots. They probably won't hit again in game two. So, you know, watch. The Cavs will win by 15 in game two, and everything will be right again. We're going to have to look at that game three. I think game three becomes very pivotal in Indiana. So, I don't know. I give the Pacers a 50-50 chance, maybe 55-45 chance to win this whole series.
Fascinating. Are you up or down on the Thunder after you've seen them one game in the playoffs?
Yeah, now that's the person who I get yelled at all the time, but I'm with Russell Westbrook, who drives me insane the way he plays, frustratingly insane. They looked really good, and the question is, it was a close game. The Jazz kept it close and, you know, had a couple shots here or there that would have changed the complexion. They probably couldn't game plan for Paul George detonating from three-point land like he did, and he hit shots that were like the guy was unconscious. So I think that's going to be a seven-game series. I had picked the Jazz anyway. I just think that their defense is so good that I just feel like they have enough components to kind of like contain and shut the Thunder down. So I'm anticipating the Jazz winning it. Probably it'll take seven games, and it also means that it'll be on the road in theory. But then again, in the more recent past, my mind feels like it's telling me that There have been a few more road seven game wins than in the past. Whereas back in the day, the home team's going to win 95% of the time.
All right, I'm going to take the Thunder. I do look. Their defense is really good in the regular season, but now your best player's got a foot issue. I struggle to buy into Rubio in the playoffs. I'm with you on Russell Westbrook. I think a lot of his flaws, people can't overlook the box score. He fills up the stat sheet like no other. But I do think, like, look, Paul George, there's going to be a game in which Carmelo goes crazy. There will be, in which he hits a bunch of shots. And I don't even know if it goes seven. I think that Quinn Snyder has coached his way, coached this team into this position, and will coach this team into a position to win some of these games. They're going to win a couple, especially at home. But I don't think they win this series. All right, Coach Nick, we really appreciate you joining us. Think you do a great job on Twitter, on your YouTube channel. Of course, download his podcast as well. Appreciate you joining us in the All Ball Podcast.
You got it.
All right, so I told you I'd tell you this story here real quick. I played at Oklahoma State. At some point in an upcoming podcast, I'll tell you kind of the whole story of my first year. Big for a good pod. But oftentimes you hear college players or fans of college players or dads be like, oh, well, just go play overseas. Just go play in Europe. Because that's where all the money is. And I remember it was January of 2001, and I went to Russia. And I went there actually on a 10-day tryout. And when I got to Perm, Russia, I was playing in Salina, Kansas in the IBA. I go to Perm, Russia. They pay me like, I'm going to say 20 grand cash to get on a plane and fly over and basically work out with the team, play one game with the team. And we'd already kind of agreed to terms of what the contract would look like if they liked me. You know, I was like a test driver for a car. So you fly overnight and, again, this is a much more intricate story than I think you want to have time for. But I remember the first morning I got up and I knew I had training. And I went to the gym, and they have a practice gym, which I don't know if every team in 2001 had one in Russia at the time. But I go up to the practice gym, and they tell me I can lift weights for an hour, and there's nobody looking over your shoulder. And remember, you come from college lifting program, and I'd had a strength coach since I was like 13 or 14 years old. And now they're like, you go lift. You have 1 hour, you know.
like close the door and you're like in a cell. And so I lifted, I worked out, and then they're like, okay, now we go, we shoot. And I walked out there, and the coach had a stopwatch and a basketball. And he throws me the basketball, and he goes, 1 minute, three-pointers. Like, all right. And there's nobody standing under the hoop to rebound for me. And so I shoot, I go get my ball, and he's like, no, we time you. How many you make in 1 minute? And so that was, it was like one of my first drills playing overseas, which is, you know, consecutively shoot for a minute, rest for a minute, shoot for a minute, rest for a minute, see how many you can make, shoot for 2 minutes, rest for 2 minutes. It was exhausting and rebounding yourself. Whereas in the States, a lot of times you always have a guy, you always have a manager or a coach, somebody rebounding you, feeding you. It's completely different. You know, we only want you to dribble back with your left hand, only want you to dribble back with your right hand. You know, you come back, you shoot a three, and then we want you to go and hesitate, cross over, shoot a pull-up jump shot. All getting your own rebound, all timing it out, and you're just gassed. Then you go home, you get something to eat, you come back, and you have practice with the team for 2 hours. Eventually, the whole team came back from a road game, and we'd lift every morning, and then we'd do shooting drills for an hour, and then we'd practice for 2 hours at night. And then you have games, and on supposedly off days, you'd probably come in and do the exact same morning workout, only you'd lift, and then you'd shoot, and then you'd end up playing, like, pickup basketball, because I played with Lithuanian guys who were crazy. The point of it is, you're at the gym a good 4 or 5 hours a day, and while you really refine your skill, you get to where you can make shots, and I've never seen guys shoot with the type of proficiency you see when you're playing professional basketball as opposed to collegiate basketball, especially foreign players, the ones that lack athleticism, they can all really shoot. But anyone who thinks, like, you just go over there and you're going to get some shots up, you're going to practice some, and you show up in games and you'll play, like, I've practiced every day of game. We practice twice a day on non-game days, every day I ever played overseas, except when there was travel or, you know, you play three in a week and you come back and you have a day off to which you're just exhausted. The point is that college basketball is great, and I would love for college coaches to have more time around their players. But some of it you need. You need the time to grow as a human being. You need some time away because professional basketball is a job, a legit job, one that they can fire you from at any point in time. Brett Brown, head coach of the 76ers, joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. You're down four, call timeout. Just after the previous timeout, you'd called timeout and said, hey, we get three stops in a row, the place is going crazy. We didn't get a chance to hear what you said when you cut it to four and they called timeout. What'd you say?
I mean, just trying to reflect back on how we were able to come down from as deep as we were. We went on a 16-2 run to get it to two. And just trying to reflect on the things defensively, especially, that allowed us to do that while, you know, sort of nominating targets, different sort of looks you hope to get to if the game became slow. We try to play fast, but if the game became slow, you know, what look did we want to live in? And those types of things.
If you could go back personally and change one thing, what would it be?
I think the play that Dwayne Wade stole the ball from Dario Saric, I give credit to Dwayne. You know, he's got that veteran sort of freedom to break a defensive, system. It's a complete sort of outlier to what they normally do. I wish we had that opportunity again. I felt like if we could have scored on that possession, things might have been a little bit differently. You know, you always watch a game and feel like there's a defining moment, like a mood swing, a single play that pivots the game. I felt like that was it. I don't know if I'd do anything differently with it, Doug, but I think that, I look back at that and sort of regret that situation more than anything.
Yeah, but that's not your, like, I know the play call, right? You're in like a horn set with two high posts, and that's on Ben Simmons, who's, you know, whether you want to call him a rookie or a redshirt rookie, like he kind of enters the ball and starts cutting instead of looking. Like, I guess you just grab him and, hey, watch out for Wade. He's going to cheat a play, you know, be sure with your passes. I mean, is that really kind of the adjustment you make and you learn, those little things that matter in playoff games that guys are able to get away with in the regular season?
I think where you're going is more true than not. You know, really, we should just be shaking Dwayne Wade's hand and saying, well done. You broke the defensive sort of scheme. You gambled and you got rewarded. And, you know, I give him credit. Dwayne, you know, read the thing well. As far as, I probably didn't answer the question the way you asked it. As far as regrets go, I don't have many. I think my point only with the Dwayne Wade situation, it was a hell of a play. And I mean, just sort of holistically, you wish that one didn't happen.
All right, so does that mean Kevin Hart is no longer welcome at a Philadelphia 76ers game? Because you've done this great job. You got messages from Barkley, Dr. J, AI was at the game right next to Kevin Hart, Eric Snow. You know, you got video messages of all the former players and that. But Kevin Hart's over there talking trash. And after the game, Dwayne Wade's like, hey, thank Kevin Hart. He motivated me.
You know, he's Philly. He's always welcome. He actually, I don't know if you realize this, Doug. I seen him shoot. He's visited us a few times, and he's got a great stroke. Like, he really still can or shoots the ball. I'm not too sure his basketball background, but he's Philly. He's profile. He can shoot. So we will welcome him with those type of qualities.
Brett Brown joining us, head coach of the Philadelphia 76ers. All right, so let's get to the Embiid thing. I thought you handled it really well, but did you, like, when you're up there at the podium and somebody asks you about an Instagram post, what's that like, to where you're looking at the box score, you're answering questions, you're still, I understand how it is, you're like, in your mind, you're like a personal DVR, you know, you're reviewing the game in your head and trying to answer questions. What's that like to be asked about an Instagram post from Joel?
Well, what had happened is right before I'm going to the podium, my PR guy, and it would have been 20 seconds before I walked into the press conference, the post-game stuff, you know, he gave me a heads up that Joel Embiid had, you know, tweeted something. He read it to me, and then it was brought up in the press conference. And what I said, I mean, you know, like, it was easy to say. I genuinely mean it. And so it was a little bit different, but I had been given a little bit of a heads up right before I walked into the room.
Okay, so does he shut down his Instagram? I mean, is there any sort of, like, repercussion for it? Because obviously you want him to play. Your team wants him to play, but you're just kind of trying to follow the doctor's orders. How have you handled it since?
I mean, that's more, you know, I think an organizational thing that is certainly discussed. I feel like with Joel, you know, normally he does not cross the line. Like, he's out there. He certainly at times is playful with social media. But this particular thing, I personally don't read much into it. And my comments last night were true. It reflects what I really think. And we move on, you know. Like, I don't think it needs to be made that big of a deal.
Brett Brown, head coach of the Philadelphia 76ers. I've been in awe of your ability to get a young player like Ben Simmons to play as well. He's not a great defensive player yet, but he was an awful defensive player in college. And you've gotten him to lock in better than anyone's ever seen him lock in. Have you done it?
I think the history that I have with his family, I coached his father a long time ago. I knew his mom and dad before they were married. You know, I've known Ben Simmons his whole sort of duration, especially with the Australian background that he has. And, you know, I just feel like that country kicks hard. That country really just loves their sport. They compete. His dad was an amazing defensive player. And we challenge him, you know. Like, I really, you know, and I appreciate it. He lets me coach him. I told him it's going to be a heck of a lot easier to impact the game for you defensively, your first year in the NBA, than it is offensively. I think some of that I was wrong. I thought I was going to be more right than maybe I have been. But the defensive side of the ball is what interests me the most. I think it's part of his culture, certainly part of his DNA with the way that his dad played. And I use all that. Like, I really challenge him and use all that.
I appreciate the fact that you're signaling when changing lanes. That is, in addition to joining us on Bluetooth, Brett Brown joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. The left-hand turn or right-hand turn? I assume left, right? You almost always signal.
That's a form of player anticipation. You are correct. That is a left-hand turn.
Okay, so I kind of think, in a crazy way, Chris Mannix joined us earlier, and he said, like, look, I think they tried to steal a game, knowing Embiid could come back, but try to get up 2-0, rest him as much as possible. But I kind of think it was better. You never want to lose, but it's better that you lost a game early like that so that your team doesn't get full of themselves. They are still, with the exception of Yasova or Marco Bellinelli, some of the veterans, and JJ, you kind of got leveled off a little bit. Can last night be something to build upon that actually helps you?
I think it can be, Doug. I don't feel for the reason you said, but I do think that. I feel like the life that we have lived here in Philadelphia, we led by me, have never gotten ahead of ourselves. We're just sort of grateful to, you know, all be fighting to continue to win. We hadn't lost since March 13th, I believe it was. And we all, like, walked into the gyms thinking that our season could end tomorrow. And that sort of just respect to how we did our jobs, that is true. That's not coach speak. I feel like, to your point of now, can it make us better? Most definitely. You know, Miami came in, they responded to a loss in a way that we talked about. And there's a difference between talking about it and for now the players feeling it. It was a physicality. There was a high level of intensity. You know, we got bent over. We got stood up. They really, I thought, did a great job of pressuring the ball. I think from that perspective, we can learn. But it is. It's a fist fight, as we both know. And we look forward to going to Miami.
Well, look, obviously everybody has been impressed with the run. It's been a long time since everyone loses at some point. Even the Warriors lost one game in the playoffs last year. Safe travels to Miami. Look forward to catching up with you soon, and continued success and health to you, Brett.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, Doug. Take care, man.
All right, Brett Brown, who joins us, fresh off a left-hand turn signal with his seatbelt on, using Bluetooth. So anybody who's thinking that he's not a safe driver, think otherwise. All right, so that's this edition of All Ball. My thanks to Coach Nick and to Coach Brett Brown, who joined us on All Ball. Can't wait to update you on the playoffs. We'll give you more great interviews. We'll find out where Romeo Langford's going. Of course, I'm with Evan Daniels. I think that this is generally what happens when guys get a new job, right? And you have a pretty good, not great, but first year, is you get the kids to stay home. It happened with Ben Howland at UCLA. He first gets there. He puts together an outstanding recruiting class. Jordan Farmar leads that Taft High School. They build that fence around the Southern California area, and that forever changed UCLA basketball during the decade he was there. They went to 3 straight Final Fours. You hire Archie Miller, and you get him in the spring, and it takes a year. But after a year, now Romeo Langford, you feel like it happens there. And then you're starting to hear kind of all of these high major schools, what they're doing. Like, look, Kansas loading up, Kentucky loading up, Duke loading up, a lot of young players, UCLA loading up. Next week we'll get to some of the other programs, which, you know, let's see what happens with Villanova, with Amari Spellman declaring for the NBA draft, not signing with an agent, but they've already lost a couple other players. Mikhail Bridges, we knew they'd lose. Jalen Brunson, we knew they'd lose. Let's find out what else happens at Villanova. But those other programs that have the older kids coming back, how can they compete? We'll compare and contrast. But again, the transfer stuff has to settle. As for the NBA, we'll update you. By the time we record the next All Ball, we're going to have, I think, more clarity on a couple of these series. It does look like the Warriors are just substantially better than the Spurs. You're up 2-0. That doesn't mean the Spurs can't pop them, can't win a game. You look around, and we'll get probably better clarity on the Cavs and just how big a trouble that they could be in. The Thunder, if you can go up 2-0. Now, remember, going back to Utah, playing in altitude, Utah always going to be better at home in a difficult road at home environment. I'll be interested to see if Minnesota can steal a game in Houston. Felt like they had a shot. Houston had them at arm's length the entire game, but they still, ball in the air, chance to tie it, send it to overtime. They had several opportunities to win that game in spite of the fact that James Harden went nuts in game one. And then you got Toronto taking on the Wizards. I personally think like that's going to, I think that's going to be an outstanding series. I think it's going to go six or seven games. I could be wrong, but I don't think that Lowry has, I think that Lowry's at a disadvantage athletically to John Wall. And no, John Wall didn't shoot well, especially in the second half of game one, but he will make some shots. They will win a couple games in this series. I just think the Wizards have too much talent to not win a couple of games. So fascinated to see what happens as the playoffs march on. We'll have more NBA draft stuff, more hoop talk, more all ball. In the meantime, remember, subscribe, download, rate the podcast, and if you have time, check out the daily Doug Gottlieb Show. It's 12 to 3 Pacific Coast time, 3 to 6 East Coast time. You can hear it on FoxSportsRadio.com. You can hear it on your iHeartRadio app, on SiriusXM Channel 83, or on any of our hundreds of affiliates. We're on Cincinnati now. We're on Phoenix now live. We're on San Diego. We're coming to other spots in the West Coast as well, live on the Doug Gottlieb Show. So, anyway, that's yet another edition of All Ball. Thanks for listening.